Fitzner finally came in, along with the state boys. I didn't tell the part about nailing one of the thugs, a dude whose mother tongue was definitely not Spanish. Why not? Fitzner wanted both of us dead, Post. He wanted to eliminate Kenny because Kenny knew something, and since I was along for the ride, it was necessary to rub me out, too. Couldn't run the risk of leaving behind a witness. Think about that, Post. A sheriff elected by the people and trusted by the entire community sends two of his men into an ambush with the plan to get both of them killed. That's Bradley Fitzner. He's still alive, you know. I don't care. My dealings with him were over 20 years ago. What did you tell him in the hospital? Everything, but the part about me nailing one of his thugs. I've never told anyone that. And I'll deny it tomorrow if you repeat it. So you're still afraid? No, Post, I'm not afraid. I'm just not risking any trouble here. No word from the guy you hit? Nothing. It was before the internet and searching was more difficult. I dug enough to learn that there were two shooting victims admitted to Tampa's public hospital on that date. One was shot by an intruder who was caught. The other guy was found dead in an alley. I couldn't prove anything, so I lost interest. About that time, my wife and I decided to leave town. How did Fitzner treat you afterwards?
The same.
He was always very professional, the perfect cop, a good leader who believed in discipline. He gave me a month of paid leave after Kenny's funeral and did everything he could to show concern. That's why he was so treacherous. The community admired him, and no one believed he was corrupt. Was it known among his men? We had our suspicions. Fitzner had two pit bulls who ran things, Chip and Dip. They were brothers, a couple of real leg breakers who did the dirty work. Arnie had a mouthful of oversized teeth, and one of his front ones was chipped. Thus, he was called Chip behind his back. Amos had smaller teeth, but a fat lower lip that was always packed with a thick wad of smokeless tobacco. Thus, Dip. Below them were a few members of their team who were in on the action, the drug payoffs. But they kept all that separate from the routine business of protecting the county. Again, Fitzner did a good job as sheriff. At some point, long before I arrived, he succumbed to the temptation of drug money. He protected the port, allowed the stuff to come in, provided safe zones to store it, and so on. I'm sure he made a mint, and I'm sure Chip and Dip and the others got their share. The rest of us had good salaries and benefits. He waves at a golf cart, and two attractive ladies wave back. He follows them around a fairway, then veers over a small bridge to a secluded hideaway under some trees. When we are settled in, I ask, "So what did Kenny know?" "I don't know. He never said. He dropped a hint one time, but never finished the conversation. You're familiar with the fire that destroyed a bunch of evidence, including stuff from the Russo murder?" "Yes, I've seen the report." "When Kenny was a kid, he wanted to be a spy. Sort of odd for a black kid in a small town in Florida, but he loved spy books and spy magazines. The CIA never called, so he became a cop. He was really good with technology and gadgets. An example, he had a friend who thought his wife was fooling around. He asked for help, and Kenny, in a matter of minutes, rigged up a phone tap in the guy's utility room. It recorded every phone call, and the guy checked the tape every day. Before long, he heard his beloved cooing with her Romeo and planning their next rendezvous. Kenny's friend caught him in bed and beat the shit out of the guy. Slapped her around, too. Kenny was right proud of himself." "So what did he hear?" "Something about the evidence getting destroyed. A few days before the Russo murder, there was a rape out in the county, white on white, and the victim said she never saw the guy's face but knew he was white. The favorite suspect was a nephew of Chip and Dip's. The rape kit was stored with the other stuff because there was no room in the old headquarters. When it burned, the rape kit was destroyed, along with other valuable proof. Kenny and I were drinking coffee late one night, taking a break, and he said something to the effect that the fire was no accident. I wanted to follow up, but we got a call and took off. I asked him about it later, and he said he overheard a conversation between Chip and Dip about burning the building. He stops talking, and there is a long pause. When I realize he's finished with the story, I ease in with, "Nothing else? That's all I have, Post, I swear." Over the years, I've speculated that Kenny had probably wired the phones around the office. He suspected Fitzner and his gang were in on the drug loot and wanted the proof. DEA was poking around, and there was talk about the feds coming in. Could we all get busted? Would Fitzner sing and blame us? I don't know. Just my best guess. But I think Kenny was listening, and he heard something. That's a pretty wild theory. Yes, it is. And you have no idea what he may have heard. Nothing, Post. No clue. He starts the cart, and we continue our tour of the course. Every turn reveals another scenic vista of mountains and valleys. We cross rushing streams on narrow wooden bridges. At the 13th tee box, he introduces me to his lawyer, who asks how things are going. We say all is well, and he hurries off with his buddies, much more concerned with his game than any of his clients' business. At the clubhouse, I thank Gilmer for his time and hospitality. We promise to talk in the near future, but both know that will not happen. It's been a long, interesting trip, but not that productive. However, in this business, that's not at all unusual. If Kenny Taft knew something, he took it to his grave. Chapter 27. Under Florida law, petitions for post-conviction relief must be filed in the county where the defendant is incarcerated instead of where he was convicted. Since Quincy is staying these days at the Garvin Correctional Institute, which is half an hour away from the small town of Peckham, which is at least an hour from civilization, his case comes under the jurisdiction of a rural circuit court ruled by a judge with a dim view of post-conviction relief. I really can't blame him. His docket is packed with all manner of junk claims filed by jailhouse lawyers toiling away inside the prison just down the road. The Poinsett County Courthouse is a tacky, modern creation designed by someone who didn't get paid much. The main courtroom is dark, windowless, and with low ceilings that create a sense of claustrophobia. The worn carpet is a dark maroon. The wood panels and furniture are stained a dark brown. I've been in at least 100 courtrooms in a dozen states, and this is by far the most depressing and dungeon-like. The state is represented by the Attorney General, a man I'll never meet, because he has about 1,000 underlings between him and me. Poor Carmen Hidalgo drew the short straw and got stuck with Quincy's petition. 5 years ago, she was in law school at Stetson, ranked in the middle of her class. Our file on her is thin, because we don't need to know much. Her response to our petition was nothing more than a stock answer with some boilerplate and all the names changed. She fully expects to win, especially given the attitude of the guy on the bench. The Honorable Jerry Plank has been mailing it in for years and dreaming of retirement. He generously set aside one full day for our hearing, but it's not 8 hours of work. Because no one cares about a case that is now 23 years old, the courtroom is empty. Even the two clerks look bored. However, we are watching and waiting. Frankie Tatum sits alone 6 rows back behind us, and Vicky Gorley sits alone 5 rows back behind the state. Both are wearing tiny video cameras that can be activated with their phones. There is no security at the door. Again, no one in this town or county has ever heard of Quincy Miller. If our efforts are being monitored by the bad guys, whoever they may be, this could be their first chance to see us in action. Courtrooms are public areas. Anyone can come and go at will. My co-counsel is Susan Ashley Gross, the warrior from the Central Florida Innocence Project. 7 years ago, Susan Ashley was with me when we walked Larry Dale Klein out of prison in Miami. He was guardian second, exoneree, her first. I would ask Susan Ashley to marry me today, but she's 15 years younger and happily engaged at the moment. Last week, I filed a motion asking the defendant to be allowed to sit through the hearing. Quincy's presence is not necessary, but I thought he might enjoy a day in the sun. Not surprisingly, Judge Plank said no. He has ruled against us on every pre-hearing matter, and we fully expect him to deny any post-conviction relief. Maisie is already working on our appeal. It's almost 10 when Judge Plank finally emerges from a hidden door behind the bench and assumes his perch. A bailiff recites his standard admonitions as we stand awkwardly. I glance around and count heads. In addition to Vicky and Frankie, there are four other spectators, and I ask myself how they could possibly care about this hearing. No one in Quincy's family knows about it. Except for one brother, no family member has contacted Quincy in years. Keith Russo has been dead for 23 years, and as far as his family is concerned, the killer was locked away a long time ago. One white male is about 50 and wears an expensive suit. One white male is about 40 and wears a black denim shirt. One white male is about 70 and has the look of the bored courthouse regular who'll sit through anything. The fourth is a white female on the front row behind us and is holding a notepad as if reporting. We filed our petition weeks ago and have not received a single inquiry from the press. I can't imagine who would be covering a hearing in a forgotten case in East Nowhere, Florida. Susan Ashley Gross calls to the stand Dr. Kyle Benderschmidt from VCU. His opinions and findings are memorialized in a thick affidavit we filed with our petition, but we decided to spend the money and produce him live. His credentials are impeccable. And as Susan Ashley is walking him through his resume, Judge Plank looks at Carmen Hidalgo and says,
"Do you have any serious objections to this man's credentials?"
She stands and simply says, "No."
"Good. Then he is accepted as an expert in the field of bloodstain analysis. Proceed."
Using four of the 8x10 color enlargements that were used at the trial, Susan Ashley leads our witness through an examination of the flashlight and the tiny specks of red matter on its lens. Judge Plank interrupts with,
"And what happened to this flashlight? It was not presented at trial, right?"
The witness shrugs because he can't testify about it. Susan Ashley says,
"Your Honor, according to the trial transcript, the sheriff testified that it was destroyed in a fire about a month after the murder, along with other evidence the police kept in storage."
"There's no trace of it?"
"Not to our knowledge, Your Honor. The state's expert, Mr. Norwood, examined these very photographs and gave the opinion that the lens of the flashlight was spattered with blood from the victim. By then, the flashlight was long gone."
"So if I understand your position, the flashlight was the only real link between Mr. Miller and the crime scene. And when the flashlight was found in the trunk of his car, he became the prime suspect. And when the jury was presented with this evidence, it deemed it sufficient for a guilty verdict."
"That's correct, Your Honor."
"Proceed."
Benderschmidt continues with his criticism of Norwood's misguided testimony. It was not based on science, because Norwood did not understand the science behind blood spatter. Bendersmit uses the word irresponsible several times to describe what Norwood told the jury. It was irresponsible to suggest the killer held the flashlight with one hand as he fired the 12-gauge shotgun with the other. There was no proof of this, no proof of where Keith was sitting or standing when he was shot, no proof of where the killer was. It was irresponsible to say that the specks were actually blood given the small amount present. It was irresponsible to even use the flashlight because it was not taken from the crime scene. After an hour, Judge Plank is exhausted and needs a break. It's not clear if he's actually sleepy, though he does seem to glaze over. Frankie quietly moves to the back row and sits next to the aisle. As the recess is called and Plank disappears, the spectators rise and leave the courtroom. As they do, Frankie catches all of them on video. After a smoke and a pee and probably a quick nap, Judge Plank reluctantly returns for more, and Bendersmit gets back on the stand. During his evaluation, he began to doubt whether the backspatter, the alleged bloody specks on the lens, was really blown backward and away from the victim. Using a diagram of Russo's office and other photos from the scene, Bendersmit testifies that based on the location of the door and the likely position of the gunman, and based on the location of Keith's body and the enormous amount of blood and matter on the walls and shelves behind it, it appears unlikely that the impact of the two shotgun blasts would have blown blood toward the killer. To buttress this opinion, Bendersmit produces some photos of other crime scenes involving 12-gauge shotgun victims. It's gory stuff, and after a few minutes, His Honor has had enough.
"Let's move on, Miss Gross. I'm not sure photos from other crimes are beneficial here."
He's probably right. On cross-examination, Carmen Hidalgo goes through the motions and scores only when she gets Bendersmit to admit that bloodstain experts often disagree, as do all experts. As the witness leaves the stand, Judge Plank looks at his watch as if he's had a long, hard morning, and he says,
"Let's break for lunch, back at 2, and hopefully you will have something new, Ms. Gross."
He wraps his gavel and disappears, and I suspect he has already reached his conclusion. In Florida, as in almost all states, post-conviction relief is considered only when new evidence is found. Not better evidence, not more credible evidence. Quincy's jury heard from Norwood, an alleged expert on bloodstains, and though his qualifications and his opinions were viciously attacked by young Tyler Townsend, the jury unanimously believed him. With Kyle Bendersmit and Tobias Black, our second bloodstain expert, we are in effect presenting evidence that is only better, but not new. Judge Plank's comment is quite revealing. As the man in the nice suit and the man in the black denim shirt leave the courtroom separately, they are being watched. We hired two private detectives to help monitor things. Frankie has already briefed them and is talking on the phone. Vicky is sitting in one of only two diners close to the courthouse, waiting. I go to the other diner and sit at the counter. Frankie emerges from the courthouse and walks to his car in a nearby parking lot. Mr. Nice Suit gets into a slick black Mercedes sedan with Florida tags. Mr. Black Denim gets into a green BMW with Florida tags. They leave downtown 2 minutes apart, and both pull into the parking lot at a shopping center on the main highway. Black Denim gets into the Mercedes, and away they go, leaving bright red flags everywhere. Sloppy. When I get word, I hustle over to the other diner where Vicky is camped out in a booth with an untouched order of fries in a basket. She's on the phone to Frankie. The Mercedes is headed south on Highway 19, and our tail has eased in behind it. Our man calls back with the tag number, and Vicky goes to work. We order iced tea and salads. Frankie arrives a few minutes later. We have seen the enemy. The Mercedes is registered to a Mr. Nash Cooley of Miami. Vicky emails this info to Maisie at home, and both women are burning up their keyboards. Within minutes, we know that Cooley is a partner in a firm that specializes in criminal defense. I call two lawyers I know in Miami. Susan Ashley Gross, who's eating a sandwich in the courtroom, calls her contacts. Maisie calls a lawyer she knows in Miami. Vicky pecks away. Frankie enjoys his tuna melt and fries. Cooley and Black Denim park at a fast food place in the town of Eustace, population 18,000, and 20 minutes away. What is obvious becomes even more so. The two men eased into town to watch the hearing, did not want to be seen together or recognized in any way, and sneaked off for a bite. As they dine, our tail exchanges cars with his colleague. When Cooley leaves Eustace and heads our way, he is being followed at a distance by another car. Cooley is a partner in a 12-member firm with a long history of representing drug dealers. Not surprisingly, it is a low-profile firm with a sparse website. They don't advertise because they don't need to. Cooley is 52, law school at Miami, a clean record with no bar complaints. His photo online needs to be updated because he appears at least 10 years younger. But this is not unusual. After our first cursory round of research, we find only one interesting story about the firm. In 1991, the guy who founded the firm was found dead in his pool with his throat slashed. The murder remains unsolved. Probably just another disgruntled client. 2 p.m. comes and goes with no sign of Judge Plank. Perhaps we should ask one of the clerks to check and see if he is, one, alive, or two, just napping again. Nash Cooley enters and sits near the back, oblivious to the fact that we know the names of his children and where they go to college. Black Denim enters a moment later and sits far away from Cooley. So amateurish. Using the services of a high-tech security firm in Fort Lauderdale, we sent a video frame of Black Denim and paid for turnaround service. The firm's facial recognition technology was primed to run the frame through the firm's many databanks. But that was unnecessary. The first databank was the Florida Department of Corrections, and the search lasted for all of 11 minutes. Black Denim is Mickey Mercado, age 43, address in Coral Gables, a convicted felon with dual citizenship, Mexican and American. When Mercado was 19, he got shipped away for 6 years for, of course, trafficking. In 1994, he was arrested and tried for murder. The jury hung and he walked. As we wait for Judge Plank, Vicky is still in the diner ordering coffee and raging through the internet. She will tell us later that Mercado is a self-employed private security consultant, whatever that means. Their identifications are stunning. And as we sit peacefully in the courtroom, it's hard not to turn around, call them by name, and say something like, "What the hell are you doing here?" But we are much too seasoned for anything like that. When possible, never let the enemy know what you know. Right now, Cooley and Mickey have no idea that we have their names, home addresses, license plate and social security numbers, and places of employment, and we are still digging. Of course, we assume that they have a file on me and Guardian and its meager staff. Frankie is nothing but a shadow and will never be caught. He's in the hallway outside the courtroom, watching and moving. There are few blacks in this town, and he is always conscious of getting looks. When Judge Plank appears at 2:17, he instructs Susan Ashley to call our next witness. There are no surprises in these hearings, so everyone knows Z. Cuffey is back in Florida. The surprise was that he agreed to testify live if we would pay his airfare. That, and I had to swear in writing
that the statute of limitations has run on perjury, so he cannot be prosecuted. These days, Zeke is just happy to be free. It won't last long, and we know it, but at least he's saying all the right things about going straight. Taking the oath, he swears to tell the truth, something he's done many times in courtrooms before commencing to lie like a polished jailhouse snitch. He tells his story about chatting with his cellmate Quincy Miller, who bragged about blowing off the head of his lawyer and tossing the 12-gauge in the Gulf. Zeke says that in return for his bogus testimony, his drug charges were greatly reduced and he was sentenced to time served. Yes, he feels bad about what he did to Quincy and has always wanted to make amends. Zeke makes a decent witness, but his problem is obvious. He's lied so many times that no one can be certain, especially his honor, if he's telling the truth now. Nonetheless, his testimony is crucial to our efforts because the recantations of witnesses do constitute new evidence. With Zeke's live testimony and Carrie Holland's affidavit, we have enough ammo to argue long and hard that Quincy's trial was not fair. If we are successful in getting a new trial, we can then present much better scientific evidence to the jury. Neither Norwood nor anyone like him will get near the courtroom. Our dream is getting the facts before a new jury. On cross, Carmen Hidalgo has far too much fun leading Zeke through his long and colorful career as a jailhouse informant. She has certified court records from 5 trials over the past 26 years in which Zeke lied to juries so he could walk. He admits to lying in that one, but not the other one. He gets confused and can't remember which lie he told in that case. It's painful to sit through, and his honor is quickly tiring. But the bloodletting continues. Ms. Hidalgo hits her stride and surprises us with her courtroom presence. By 3:30, Judge Plank is yawning and squinting and obviously checking out. He's exhausted and trying desperately to stay awake. I whisper to Susan Ashley to wrap things up and let's get out of here. Chapter 28. The day after Vicky and I return to Savannah, we gather in the conference room with Maisie to assess the case. Florida, like Alabama, does not impose a deadline on judges in post-conviction matters, so old Plank might die before he decides anything. We suspect he's already made up his mind, but he'll take plenty of time before he rules. There's nothing we can do to prod him along, and it would be counterproductive to try to do so. We are assuming that we are being watched at some level, and this provokes a spirited discussion. We agree that all digital files and communications must be upgraded and heavily secured. This will cost about $30,000, cash that's not in our beleaguered budget. The bad guys have unlimited money and can buy the best surveillance. I seriously doubt that they will snoop around Savannah and watch our movements. That would only bore them and yield no useful information. However, we agree that we must become more vigilant and vary our routines. They could have easily followed me to Nassau and tracked me as I met with Tyler Townsend. Same for Sun Valley and Bruce Gilmer. But those trips were before we filed our petition and before our names were officially entered. Of Nash Cooley, we have learned more. We have public data regarding his autos, real estate, and both divorces. Suffice to say, he makes a lot of money and likes to spend it. His home in Coral Gables is assessed at $2.2 million. He has at least 3 cars titled in his name, all German imports. His firm operates out of a sparkling new high-rise in downtown Miami with branches on Grand Cayman and in Mexico City. According to a friend of Susan Ashley's, some drug lawyers in South Florida are known to take fees offshore. They are rarely caught, but occasionally the feds will bust one for tax evasion. This source says that Varick and Valencia has been in the dirty business for a long time and is quite adept at advising its clients on the more sanitary ways of laundering money. Two of the firm's senior partners are veteran courtroom brawlers with many victories to their credit. In 1994, they defended Mickey Mercado on a murder charge and hung the jury. I cannot understand the logic of Nash Cooley making the six-hour drive to watch our post-conviction hearing. If he wanted a good look at me, he could have gone to our website, simple as it is. Same for Susan Ashley. All of the petitions, motions, briefs, and rulings are public record, easily findable online. And why would he run the risk of being spotted? Granted, the risk was quite low in that backward part of the state, but nonetheless, he got himself identified by us. I can assume only that Cooley was there because a client ordered him there. Mickey Mercado is a career thug who has probably worked for a cartel his entire adult life. Which cartel? We are not certain. He and two others were charged with murdering another drug trafficker in a deal gone bad, but the feds couldn't make it stick. Now he's trailing me? I make the point to the ladies that looking over our shoulders will not help Quincy Miller. Our job is to prove him innocent and not necessarily to identify the guy who pulled the trigger. I have not told the ladies everything. I seldom do. The story of Tyler and the crocodiles is one I'll keep to myself. That image never goes away. Our discussion about Tyler goes on throughout most of the day as we go back and forth with ideas and arguments. On the one hand, I feel compelled to reach out again and at least warn him that our efforts are now being monitored. On the other hand, though, the mere act of contacting him could potentially place him in danger. The same goes for Gilmer, but he does not know as much as Tyler. At the end of the day, we decide it's an important risk to take. I go online and return to From Under Patty's Porch, where I pay $20 for another month and send a message that will erase itself in 5 minutes. Nassau again. Important. 5 minutes pass with no response. I send the same message 4 times over the next 3 hours and hear nothing. After dark, I leave the office and walk a few blocks in sweltering heat. The days are long and humid, and the town is crowded with tourists. As usual, Luther Hodges is waiting on his porch, eager to get out of the house. "Hello, Padre," I call out.
"Hello, my son."
We embrace on the sidewalk, exchange lighthearted insults about gray hair and waistlines, and start walking. After a few minutes, I realize something is bothering him.
"Texas will kill another one tomorrow," he explains.
"Sorry to hear." Luther is a tireless abolitionist whose simple message has always been, since we can all agree that it's wrong to kill, why do we allow the state to kill? When an execution appears on the horizon, he and his fellow abolitionists write the usual letters, make calls, post comments online, and occasionally go to the prison to protest. He spends hours in prayer and grieves for murderers he's never met. We're not in the mood for a fancy meal, so we duck into a sandwich shop. He pays for mine, as always, and as soon as we're seated, he grins and says,
"Now, tell me the latest on Quincy's case."
Since Guardian began its work, we have opened 18 cases, 8 of which resulted in exonerations. 1 client was executed, 6 are current, 3 we closed when we became convinced our clients were indeed guilty. When we make a mistake, we cut our losses and move on. With 18 cases, we have learned that sooner or later, we'll get a lucky break. His name is Lynn Duckworth, and he lives at Sea Island, about an hour south of Savannah. He drove up, walked into our headquarters, saw no one at the reception desk, stuck his head into Vicky's room, and said hello. Vicky was polite, as always, but very busy.
Within minutes, though, she was calling for me.
"This could be important," she says.
We eventually settle in the conference room upstairs with a fresh pot of coffee. Vicky and Maisie take notes, and I just listen. Duckworth is about 70, tanned and trim, the epitome of a comfortable retiree with plenty of time for golf and tennis. He and his wife moved to Sea Island a few years back and are trying to stay busy. He's from Ohio. She's from Chicago. Both prefer warm weather. He was an FBI agent in 1973 when Congress created the Drug Enforcement Agency, which sounded more exciting than his desk job. He switched agencies and spent his career with the DEA, including 12 years in charge of North Florida. For months now, we've been trying with no success to obtain DEA records from the 1980s. But like the FBI and the ATF, the DEA is tenacious about protecting its archives. One of Vicky's FOIA requests came back with a letter in which every word was redacted except for the A's and the's. This is indeed a lucky day. Duckworth says, "I know a lot about the drug business back then. Some things I can talk about, some I cannot." I say, "I'm curious about why you came here. We've been trying to get DEA files and notes for the past 7 months with no luck." "You won't get much because DEA always hides behind the excuse that its investigations are active and ongoing. It doesn't matter how old or inactive a case might be. The DEA's procedure is to give you nothing, and they'll go to court to protect their information. That's the way we operate it." "How much can you tell us?" I ask. "Well, I can talk about the murder of Keith Russo because the case was closed over 20 years ago and because it wasn't a DEA matter. I knew Keith, knew him well because we flipped him. He was one of our informants, and that's what got him killed." Vicky, Maisie, and I look at each other as this settles in. The only person on the planet who can confirm that Keith Russo was an informant is sitting in one of our old mismatched chairs and calmly sipping coffee. "Who killed him?" I asked tentatively.
"Don't know, but it wasn't Quincy Miller. It was a hit from the cartel."
"Which cartel?" He pauses and takes a sip of coffee. "You ask me why I came here. I heard about your efforts to exonerate Miller, and I applaud what you're doing. They got the wrong guy because they wanted the wrong guy. I have a lot of background I can share without divulging confidential stuff. Primarily, though, I just wanted to get out of the house. My wife is shopping today around the corner, and we'll meet for a nice lunch later." I say, "We're all ears, and we have all day." "Okay. First, a bit of history. By the mid-1970s, when the DEA was created, cocaine was raging across the country and coming in by the ton in ships, planes, trucks, you name it. The demand was insatiable. Profits were enormous, and the growers and traffickers could barely keep up. They built huge organizations throughout Central and South America and stashed their money in Caribbean banks. Florida, with 800 miles of beaches and dozens of ports, became the preferred point of entry. Miami became the playground for the traffickers. South Florida was controlled by a Colombian cartel, one that is still in business. I was not involved down there. My section was from Orlando North, and by 1980, the Saltillo cartel out of Mexico ran most of the cocaine. Saltillo is still around, but it got merged with a bigger outfit. Most of its leaders got butchered in a drug war. These gangs are always up and down, and the casualties are breathtaking. The savagery is unbelievable. I won't bore you."
"Please don't," Vicky says.
I have another quick visual of Tyler and the crocodile feast and say, "We have a fair amount of background on Sheriff Fitzner and what went on in Ruiz County." He smiles and shakes his head, as if reminded of an old friend. "And we never caught that guy. He was the only sheriff that we knew of in North Florida who was in bed with the cartel. We had him in our sights when Russo got hit. Things changed after that. Some of our crucial informants got lockjaw.
How did you flip Russo? I asked.
Keith was an interesting guy. Very ambitious. Tired of the small town. Wanted to make a lot of money. Damn good lawyer. He had some drug clients in the Tampa-St. Pete area and sort of made a name for himself. An informant told us that he was taking big fees in cash, reporting some or none, even moving money offshore. We watched his tax returns for a couple of years, and it was obvious he was spending a lot more than he was making on Main Street in Seabrook. So we met with him and threatened him with an indictment for evasion. He knew he was guilty and didn't want to lose everything. He was also guilty of laundering money for some of his clients, primarily the Saltillo boys. He did this by using offshore shell companies to buy Florida real estate and doing all the paperwork. Not terribly complicated stuff, but he knew what he was doing. Did his wife know he was an informant? Another smile. Another sip. Duckworth could tell war stories for hours. This is where it gets really fun. Keith liked the ladies. He was careful not to chase them in Seabrook, but Tampa was another story. He and Diana kept an apartment there, ostensibly for reasons related to their work, but Keith used it for other reasons. Before we flipped him, we got warrants and had bugs in the apartment, office, even at home. We were listening to everything, including Keith's calls to his girls. Then we got a real shock. Seems as though Diana decided to play the same game. Her dude was one of her drug clients, a pretty boy who worked in Miami for the Saltillo cartel. Ramon Vasquez was his name. There were a couple of times when Keith was in Tampa hard at work, and Ramon sneaked into Seabrook to visit Diana. Anyway, you can imagine what kind of shape the marriage was in. So, to answer your question, we were never sure if Keith told his wife about being an informant. We warned him not to, of course.
What happened to Diana?
Vicky asks. Somehow the cartel found out about Keith working for us. I strongly suspect that another informant, a double agent, one of our guys, sold the information. It's a dirty business with loyalties that can change daily. Hard cash and the fear of being burned alive can flip a lot of people. They took out Keith, and Diana eventually left town.
And Ramon?
Asks Maisie. He and Diana hooked up in Tampa for a while, then kept moving south. We didn't know for sure back then, but we suspected he sort of semi-retired from his trafficking career and stayed out of trouble. Last I heard, they were still together somewhere in the Caribbean.
With plenty of money, I say.
Yes, with plenty of money.
Was she involved with the murder?
Maisie asks. That has never been proven. You know about the life insurance and the joint bank accounts, but that's not too unusual.
I ask, why didn't you bust Fitzner and the cartel?
Well, after the murder, the case evaporated. We were within a month or two of a huge bust that would have produced a lot of indictments, including some charges against Fitzner. We had been patient, too patient, really. But we were fighting with the U.S. Attorney's Office down there. They were overworked and so on. We couldn't get the lawyers fired up. You know how they are. After the murder, our informants vanished, and the case fell apart. The cartel got spooked and pulled back for a while. Fitzner eventually retired. I was moved to Mobile, where I finished my career.
Who would the cartel use to do the killing? Maisie asks.
Oh, they have plenty of gun thugs, and these guys are not always sophisticated assassins. They're brutes who'd rather cut off a man's head with an axe than put a bullet in it. A couple of shotgun blasts to the face is tame for these boys. Their murders are messy because they want them to be. If they leave behind clues, they don't care. You're never going to find them because they're back in Mexico or Panama, somewhere in the jungle. Maisie says,
but the Russo crime scene was clean, right? No clues left behind.
Yes,
but Fitzner was in charge of the investigation. I say, I'm not sure I understand why you couldn't nail Fitzner. You say you knew he was guarding the port, storing the coke, protecting the dealers, and you had informants, including Keith. Why couldn't you bust him? Duckworth takes a deep breath and locks his hands behind his head. He stares at the ceiling, keeps a smile on his face, replies, "That is probably the biggest disappointment of my career. We really wanted that guy. One of us, a law enforcement man, on the take and in bed with the nastiest people you could ever meet. Pumping cocaine into Atlanta, Birmingham, Memphis, Nashville, all over the Southeast. And we could have done it. We had infiltrated. We had built the case. We had the evidence. It was the U.S. attorney in Jacksonville. We just could not get him to move fast enough and take it to the grand jury. He insisted on running the show and didn't know what he was doing. Then Russo got hit. I still think about that guy, the U.S. attorney. He later ran for Congress, and I couldn't wait to vote against him. Last I heard, he was chasing ambulances with his smarmy face on billboards. Maisie asked, "And you say this cartel is still around?" "Most of it is, or at least it was when I retired. I've been out of the loop for the past 5 years." Maisie says, "Okay, let's talk about the people who ordered the hit on Russo. Where are they now?" "Dunno. I'm sure some are dead. Some are in prison. Some have retired to their mansions around the world. And some are still trafficking."
"Are they watching us?"
Vicky asks. Duckworth leans forward and takes a sip. He thinks about this for a long moment because he appreciates our concern. Finally, he says, "I can only speculate, obviously. But yes, they are watching at some level. They do not want Quincy Miller exonerated, to say the least." "I have a question for you," he says, looking at me. "If your client walks, will the murder case be reopened?" "Probably not. In about half of our cases, we manage to identify the real perpetrator. The other half, we do not. Here, it looks highly unlikely. The case is old. The evidence is gone. The real killer is, as you say, living well somewhere far away." "Or he's dead," Duckworth says. "Gun thugs don't last long in the cartels."
"So why are they watching us?" Vicky asks.
"Why not? You're easy to watch. The court filings are public. Why not keep up with things?" I ask, "Ever hear of a Miami drug lawyer named Nash Cooley?" "I don't think so. Is he with a firm?" "Varick and Valencia." "Oh, sure. They've been around for years, well known in the trade." "Why do you ask?" "Nash Cooley was in the courtroom last week when we argued our motion."
"So you know him?"
"No, but we identified him. He was with a guy named Mickey Mercado, one of his clients. Being a good cop, he wants to ask how we identified the two, but he lets it go. He smiles and says, "Yes, I'd be careful if I were you. It's safe to assume they're watching."
Chapter 29. According to Steve Rosenberg, Judge Marlowe has more clout than we gave her credit for. He suspects she lobbied the Alabama Court of Appeals to move at what could be a record pace. Barely 2 months after the hearing in Verona, the court unanimously affirms Judge Marlowe's command to DNA test the 7 pubic hairs, and they order the testing to be paid for by the office of the Honorable Chad Fallwright. Two detectives from the state police drive the evidence to the same lab in Durham that we used to test the saliva of Mark Carter. I stare at my phone for 3 days until it buzzes with a call from Her Honor herself. With perfect unaccented diction and in the most beautiful female voice I have ever heard, she says,
"Well, Mr. Post, it appears as though you are correct. Your client has been excluded by DNA testing. All 7 pubic hairs once belonged to Mr. Carter."
I'm in Vicky's office and my face says it all. I close my eyes for a moment as Vicky quietly hugs Maisie. Her Honor continues, "Today is Tuesday. Can you be here for a hearing on Thursday?" "Of course. And thank you, Judge Marlowe."
"Don't thank me, Mr. Post. Our judicial system owes an enormous debt of gratitude to you."
These are the moments we live for. Alabama came within 2 hours of killing an innocent man. Duke Russell would be cold in his grave if not for us and our work and our commitment to undoing wrongful convictions. But we'll celebrate later. I leave immediately and head west toward Alabama, phoning nonstop. Chad doesn't want to talk, and of course, he's far too busy at the moment. Since he'll try to screw things up again, and since he's incompetent to begin with, we're worried about the apprehension of Mark Carter. To our knowledge, Carter knows nothing about the DNA testing. Steve Rosenberg convinces the Attorney General to call Chad and get him in line. The AG also agrees to notify the state police and ask them to keep an eye on Carter. Late Wednesday morning, Duke Russell is lying on his bunk, the same one he's had for the past 10 years, reading a paperback and minding his own business, when a guard looks through the bars and says,
"Hey, Duke, time to go, man."
"Go where?"
"Going home. A judge wants to see you in Verona. Leaving in 20 minutes. Get packed."
The guard shoves a cheap duffel through the bars, and Duke begins stuffing in his assets. Socks, T-shirts, boxers, 2 pairs of sneakers, toiletries. He owns 8 paperbacks, and since he's read each at least 5 times, he decides to leave them for the next guy. Same for his small black-and-white TV and rotating fan. By the time he walks out of his cell, in handcuffs but no leg irons, his comrades are cheering and clapping. Near the front door, the other guards have gathered to slap him on the back and wish him well. Several walk him outside where a white prison van is waiting. As he leaves death row, he refuses to look back. At Holman's administration building, he is transferred to a county patrol car and whisked away. Once outside the prison, the car stops and the deputy in the front passenger seat gets out. He opens a rear door, unlocks the handcuffs, and asks Duke if he would like something to eat. Duke thanks him but declines. His emotions are overwhelming his appetite. 4 hours later, he arrives at the county jail, where I'm waiting with Steve Rosenberg and a lawyer from Atlanta. We've convinced the sheriff that Duke is about to be released because he is, in fact, innocent, so the sheriff is cooperating. He allows us to use his cramped office for our little meeting. I explain what I know to my client, which is not everything. Tomorrow, Judge Marlowe plans to vacate his conviction and order his release from custody. Idiot Chad is threatening to refile charges against not only Duke, but Mark Carter as well. His bizarre new theory is that the two of them tag-teamed the rape and murder of Emily Brune. The two of them have never met. As outrageous as this sounds, it is not surprising. When boxed in and bleeding, prosecutors often become wildly creative with new theories of guilt. The fact that Mark Carter's name was never mentioned at Duke's trial 10 years ago will kill this nonsense. Judge Marlowe is on the warpath and will not listen to it. And the Alabama Attorney General is putting pressure on Chad to back off. Nonetheless, he has the power to refile charges, and it is something to worry about. He could have Duke arrested not long after he's released. As I try to explain these legal vagaries to my client, he becomes too emotional to talk. We leave him with the sheriff, who takes him to the nicest cell for his last night in captivity. Steve and I drive to Birmingham and have drinks with Jim Bisco of the Birmingham News. He's rabid with the story and has circulated the gossip among his colleagues. Tomorrow, he promises us, will be a circus. We have a late dinner and find a cheap motel, one far away from Verona. We do not feel safe staying there. The victim's family is large and has many friends. and we've had anonymous phone threats. They, too, are part of the business. Before dawn, Mark Carter is arrested by the state police and taken to a jail in a county next door. The sheriff tells us this as we enter the courtroom and prepare for the hearing. As we wait, and as a crowd gathers, I look out the window and notice brightly painted television vans in front of the courthouse. At 8:30, Chad Fallwright arrives with his little gang and says good morning. I ask him if he still plans to re-indict my client. He smiles smugly and says no. He is thoroughly beaten. And at some point during the night, probably after a tense phone chat with the Attorney General, he decided to call it quits. Duke arrives with his uniformed escorts, and he's all smiles. He's wearing an oversized navy jacket, a white shirt, and a tie with a knot as big as a fist. He looks splendid and is already savoring the moment. His mother is on the front row behind us, along with at least a dozen relatives. Across the aisle is Jim Bisco and several reporters. Judge Marlowe is allowing still photography, and cameras are clicking. She assumes the bench promptly at 9 and says good morning.
Before we get started, I have been asked by Sheriff Pilley to inform the public and the press that a resident of this county, a man named Mark Carter, was arrested this morning at his home in Bayless and charged with the rape and murder of Emily Brune. He remains in custody and will appear in this courtroom in about an hour. Mr. Post, I believe you have a motion.
I rise with a smile and say, yes, Your Honor. On behalf of my client, Duke Russell, I ask that his conviction entered in this case be vacated and that he be released immediately.
And what is the basis of this motion?
DNA testing, Your Honor. We have obtained DNA testing on the 7 pubic hairs found at the crime scene. Mr. Russell is excluded. All 7 originated from Mr. Carter.
And as I understand the facts, Mr. Carter was the last person seen with the victim while she was still alive. Is that so?
She asks this as she glares at Chad.
That is correct, Your Honor, I say with suppressed glee.
And Mr. Carter was never considered a serious suspect by the police or the prosecutor.
Thank you. Mr. Fallwright, do you oppose this motion?
He rises quickly and almost whispers,
the state does not.
She reshuffles some papers and takes her time. Finally, she says,
Mr. Russell, would you please stand?
He gets to his feet and looks at her as if bewildered. She clears her throat and says,
Mr. Russell, your convictions for rape and capital murder are hereby vacated and dismissed forever, and they cannot be brought back. I was not involved in your trial, obviously, but I do consider it a privilege to be involved here today with your exoneration. A grave miscarriage of justice has occurred, and you have paid a dear price. You were wrongfully convicted by the state of Alabama and incarcerated for a decade, years that can never be replaced. On behalf of the state, I say that I'm sorry. And I realize my apology does not even begin to heal your wounds. However, it is my hope that one day soon you will remember the apology and take some small measure of comfort in it. I wish you a long, happy life with this nightmare behind you. Mr. Russell, you are free to go.
There are gasps and shrieks behind us as his family hears this. Duke leans forward and places both hands on the table. I stand and put an arm around him as he sobs. For some reason, I notice how frail and thin he is in someone's old sports coat. Chad hits a side door and makes his escape, too cowardly to walk over and offer an apology of his own. He'll probably spend the rest of his career lying about how Duke got off on one of those technicalities. Outside the courtroom, we face the cameras and answer questions. Duke says little. He just wants to go home and eat his uncle's barbecue ribs. I don't have much to say either. Most lawyers dream of these moments, but to me, they are bittersweet. On the one hand, there is immense satisfaction in saving an innocent man. But on the other, there is anger and frustration with a system that allows wrongful convictions. Almost all can be avoided. Why are we expected to celebrate after an innocent man is freed? I navigate through the crowd and walk with my client to a small room where Jim Bisco is waiting. I promised him an exclusive, and Duke and I unload. Bisco starts with questions about his near miss with the executioner 7 months earlier, and before long, we're laughing about Duke's last meal and his frantic efforts to finish his steak and cake before returning to his cell. The laughter feels good and comes easily, as do the tears. After half an hour, I leave them and return to the courtroom, where the crowd is loitering and waiting for the next bit of drama. Judge Marlowe assumes the bench, and everyone takes a seat. She nods, and a bailiff opens a side door. Mark Carter appears in handcuffs and the standard orange jumpsuit. He glances around, sees the crowd, finds his family on the front row, then looks away. He takes a seat at the defense table and stares down as his boots catch his attention. Judge Marlowe looks at him and asks, "Are you Mark Carter?" He nods. "Please stand when I address you and answer in a clear voice." He reluctantly gets to his feet as if he's in control of the moment.
"I am."
"Do you have a lawyer?"
"Nope."
"Can you afford one?"
"Depends on how much one might cost."
"Very well. I'll appoint one for now, and he'll meet you over in the jail. We'll come back next week and try again. In the meantime, you will be held without bail. Have a seat." He sits and I ease forward to the defense table. I lean down and in a low voice say, "Hey, Mark. I'm the guy who called you the night they almost killed Duke. Remember the call?" He glares, and since he's cuffed and can't throw a punch, he looks as though he might spit. "Anyway, I called you a cowardly scumbag because you were willing to let another man die for your crime, and I promised I'd see you in court." "Who are you?" he snarls. A bailiff is moving toward us, and I back away. In a brief ceremony, the staff at Guardian hangs a large framed color photo of Duke Russell on the wall with the other 8 exonerees. It is a handsome portrait we paid for. Our client is posing outdoors at his mother's home, leaning on a white board fence with a fishing rod at his side, a big smile, the contented face of a man happy to be free and young enough to enjoy another life. A life we've given him. We pause and pat ourselves on the back, then return to our work. Chapter 30. Quincy thinks I'm here because I'm his lawyer, and part of my job is to see my clients at every opportunity. This is my 4th visit, and I bring him up to date. Of course, we have heard nothing from Judge Plank just down the road, and Quincy does not understand why we can't file a complaint and make the old fossil do something. I describe Zeke Huffey's performance in court and pass along the guy's apology for helping send Quincy to prison for the rest of his life. Quincy is unmoved. We kill 2 hours covering the same material. Leaving the prison, I head south on a county road that soon expands to 4, then 6 lanes as Orlando looms. Watching the rearview mirror has become a habit that I hate, but I can't make myself stop. I know there's no one back there. If they are listening and watching, they wouldn't do it with such an antiquated method. They might hack phones and computers and who knows what else, but they wouldn't waste their time chasing me in my little Ford SUV. I take a quick exit onto a busy thoroughfare, then another quick turn and wheel into the vast parking lot of a suburban mall. I park between two cars, walk inside like an average shopper, and hike at least half a mile to a sprawling Nike store where at exactly 2:15 I find a rack of men's running shirts. Tyler Townsend waits on the other side of the rack. He's wearing a golf cap from a country club and a pair of fake tortoiseshell glasses. Glancing around, he says softly, "This better be good." I examine a shirt and say, "We have seen the enemy, and I think you should know about it." "I'm listening," he says without looking at me. I tell him about the hearing in front of Judge Plank, the appearance of Nash Cooley and Mickey Mercado, and their clumsy efforts to avoid being seen together. Tyler does not recognize either name. A kid with a big smile approaches and asks if we need help. I politely wave him off. I give Tyler all the background we have on both Mercado and Cooley. I summarize what Len Duckworth told us about the DEA and the cartel. "You suspected Russo was an informant, didn't you?" I ask. "Well, he was killed for a reason. Either his wife had him knocked off for the life insurance, which no one really ever believed, or he got in too thick with some of his shady clients. I've always figured it was the work of the drug gang. That's how they handle informants, like those two boys I described down in Belize, or wherever it was. Remember the photo post? Me on the zip line? I think about it all the time, and so do I. Look, Post, if they're watching you, then we ain't gonna be pals no more. I don't want to see you again." He takes a step back, glaring at me. "Nothing, Post. You hear? No contact whatsoever." I nod and say, "Got it." At the door, he scans the mall, as if he might see a couple of thugs with large guns, then walks away as nonchalantly as possible. He quickens his pace and is soon out of sight. And I realize how utterly terrified he is by the past. The question is, how terrified should we be of the present? The answer arrives within hours. We select our cases with great care, and once engaged, we investigate and litigate with diligence. Our goal is to find the truth and exonerate our clients, something we've now done 9 times in the past 12 years. However, it has never occurred to me that our efforts to save a client might get one killed. It was a prison beating with all the markings of an ambush, and as such, it will be difficult to get the facts. Witnesses are unreliable if they come forward at all. Guards often see nothing. The administration has every reason to cover up and to slant its version in a way most favorable to the prison. Not long after I said goodbye to Quincy that morning, he was jumped by 2 men in a walkway between a machine shop and a gymnasium. He was stabbed by a shank and beaten severely by blunt instruments and left for dead. A guard eventually walked by, saw him lying in a pool of blood, and called for help. He was loaded into an ambulance and taken to the nearest hospital, and from there was rushed to Mercy Hospital in Orlando. Tests revealed a fractured skull, swollen brain, broken jaw, splintered shoulder and collarbone, missing teeth, and so on, and 3 deep stab wounds. He was given 6 pints of blood and put on life support. When the prison finally called our office in Savannah, Vicky was informed that he was critical and not expected to survive. I was on the Jacksonville bypass when she called me with the news. I forgot all the other clutter in my brain and turned around. Quincy has no family to speak of. Right now, he needs his lawyer. I have spent half of my career hanging around prisons, and I've become accustomed to the violent culture, but not calloused by it, because caged men will always invent new ways to harm one another. But I've never considered the possibility of an innocence case being derailed from inside the prison by rubbing out the prospective exoneree. It's a brilliant move. If Quincy dies, we close the file and move on. This is not an established policy at Guardian because we've never been confronted with such a death. But with an endless supply of cases to choose from, we cannot justify our time in trying to exonerate anyone posthumously. I'm sure they know that, whoever they might be. For purposes of my own lengthy monologues behind the wheel, I suppose I could refer to them as the Saltillo Gang or something like that. But they works better. So they are watching our court filings. Perhaps they are trailing us occasionally, maybe hacking a bit and eavesdropping. And they certainly know about us